This story is called The Happy Couple. I don't know that I very much liked Landon. He was a member of a club I belonged to, and I'd often sat next to him at luncheon. He was a judge at the Old Bailey, and it was through him I was able to get a privileged seat in court when there was an interesting trial that I wanted to attend. He was an imposing figure on the bench in his great full-bottomed wig, his red robes and his ermine tippet, and with his long white face, thin lips and pale blue eyes, a somewhat terrifying one. I knew he liked to talk to me, but I never thought he looked upon me as anything but a club acquaintance, so I was not a little surprised when one day I received a telegram from him saying that he was spending his vacation on the Riviera and would like to stay with me for 2 or 3 days on his way to Italy. I vowed that I should be glad to see him. On the day of his arrival, to help me out, I asked Miss Gray, a neighbour and an old friend of mine, to dinner. She was of mature age, but charming, and she had a flow of lively conversation which I knew nothing could discourage. The dinner was a success. The good wine and Miss Gray's sprightly chatter combined to give Landon a geniality I had never before seen in him. It was plain to me that, notwithstanding his austere appearance, he liked feminine society. And Miss Gray, in a becoming dress, with her neat head only just touched with grey, was still alluring. After dinner, the judge, with some old brandy still further to mellow him, let himself go, and for a couple of hours held us entranced while he told us of celebrated trials in which he had been concerned. I wasn't surprised, therefore, that when Miss Gray asked us to lunch with her next day, Landon, even before I could answer, accepted with alacrity. A very nice woman, he said when she'd left us, and a head on her shoulders. She must have been very pretty as a girl. Why isn't she married? She always says nobody asked her. Stuff and nonsense. Women ought to marry. Too many of these women about who want their independence. I have no patience with them. Miss Gray lived in a little house facing the sea at Saint-Jean, which is a couple of miles from my own house at Cap Ferrat. We drove down next day at 1 and were shown into her living room. I have a surprise for you, she said to me as we shook hands. The Craigs are coming. You've got to know them at last. Well, I thought it was too absurd that we should live next door to one another and bathe from the same beach every day and not speak. So I forced myself on them and they promised to come to lunch today. She turned to Landon. I hope you don't mind. I'm sure I shall be delighted to meet any friends of yours, Miss Gray, he said. But they're not friends of mine. I've seen a lot of them, but I never spoke to them until yesterday. It'll be a treat for them to meet an author and a celebrated judge. I'd heard a good deal of the Craigs from Miss Gray during the previous 3 weeks. They'd taken the cottage next to hers, and at first she feared they'd be a nuisance. But she very quickly discovered that the Craigs were as plainly disinclined to strike up an acquaintance with her as she with them. Though in that little place they couldn't but meet 2 or 3 times a day, the Craigs never by so much as a glance gave an indication that they'd ever seen her before. Miss Gray told me she thought it very tactful of them to make no attempt to intrude upon her privacy, but I had an idea that she was puzzled that they apparently wanted to know her as little as she wanted to know them. On one occasion, while we were walking together, we passed them, and I was able to have a good look at them. Craig was a handsome man with a red, honest face, a grey moustache and thick, strong grey hair. He held himself well, and there was a bluff heartiness of manner about him that suggested a broker who had retired on a handsome fortune. His wife was a woman hard of visage, tall and of masculine appearance, with dull fair hair too elaborately dressed, a large nose, a large mouth, and a weather-beaten skin. She was not only homely, but grim. I thought he looked commonplace and she looked disagreeable, and it seemed to me that Miss Gray was lucky that they were so obviously disposed to keep themselves to themselves. There's something rather charming about them, she told me. What? They love one another and they adore the baby. For they had a child that was not more than a year old, and from this Miss Gray concluded that they hadn't long been married. She liked to watch them with their baby, The nurse took it out every morning in a pram, but before this, father and mother spent an ecstatic quarter of an hour teaching it to walk. They stood a few yards apart and urged the child to flounder from one to the other, and each time it tumbled into the parental arms, it was lifted up and rapturously embraced. Miss Gray used often to see them walking up and down the lawn of their garden arm in arm. They didn't talk, as though they were so happy to be together the conversation was unnecessary. And it warmed her heart to observe the affection which that dour, unsympathetic woman had so obviously for her tall, handsome husband. And it looked as though he loved her as much as she loved him. Every now and then he would give her a glance, and she would look up at him and smile, and he gave her cheek a little pat. But because they were no longer young, their mutual devotion was peculiarly touching. Because she didn't know what their first names were, Miss Gray called them Edwin and Angelina. She made up a story about them. She told it me one day, and this, as far as I remember, is how it went. They had fallen in love with one another years before, perhaps 20 years. It was impossible for them to marry because they neither of them had a penny to bless himself with. But they had courage, hope, and confidence. Edwin made up his mind to go out to South Africa, make his fortune, and return to marry the girl who had patiently waited for him. Meanwhile, of course, Angelina would live with her widowed mother. But things didn't pan out according to schedule. Edwin found it more difficult than he'd expected to make a fortune, and only Angelina's love and her tender letters gave him the heart to continue the struggle. At the end of 5 years, he was no better off than when he started. Angelina would willingly have joined him and shared his poverty, but it was impossible for her to leave her mother, bedridden as she was, poor thing, and there was nothing for them to do but have patience. And so the years passed slowly, and Edwin's hair grew grey, and Angelina became grim and haggard. She wondered if Edwin still loved her. She wondered if he would ever come back. She often despaired. 10 years went by, and 15 and 20. Then Edwin wrote to say that his affairs were settled, and he had made enough money for them to live upon in comfort, and if she was still willing to marry him, he would return at once. By a merciful interposition of Providence, Angelina's mother chose that very moment to abandon a world in which she had made herself a thorough nuisance. But when, after so long a separation, they met, Angelina saw with dismay that Edwin was as young as ever. It's true his hair was grey, but it infinitely became him. He'd always been good-looking, but now he was a handsome man in the flower of his age. She felt as old as the hills. He was gay and breezy as of old, but her spirit was crushed. The bitterness of life had warped her soul. It seemed monstrous to bind that alert and active man to her by a promise 20 years old, and she offered him his release. He went deathly pale. "Don't you care for me any more?" he cried brokenly. And she realized on a sudden, oh, the rapture, oh, the relief, that to him, too, she was just the same as she'd ever been. He had thought of her always as she was. Her portrait had been, as it were, stamped on his heart, so that now, when the real woman stood before him, she was to him still 18. So they were married. "I don't believe a word of it," I said when Miss Gray had brought her story to its happy ending. "I insist on your believing it," she said. "I'm convinced it's true, and I haven't the smallest doubt that they'll live happily together to a ripe old age." While I've told you this idyllic story of Miss Gray's invention, the three of us, our hostess, Landon, and myself, waited for the Craigs to come. "Have you ever noticed that if people live next door to you, they're invariably late?" Miss Gray asked the judge. "No, I haven't," he answered acidly. "I'm always punctual myself, and I expect other people to be punctual. I suppose it's no good offering you a cocktail, none whatever, madam, but I have some sherry that they tell me isn't bad." The judge took the bottle out of our hands and looked at the label. A faint smile broke on his lips. "This is a civilized drink, Miss Gray. With your permission, I will help myself. I never knew a woman yet who knew how to pour out a glass of wine. One should hold a woman by the waist, but a bottle by the neck." Miss Gray glanced out to the window. Oh, that's why the Craigs are late. They were waiting for the baby to come back. I followed her eyes and saw that the nurse had just pushed the pram past Miss Gray's house on her way home. Craig took the baby out of the pram and lifted it high in the air. The baby, trying to tug at his moustache, crowed gleefully. Mrs. Craig stood by watching, and the smile on her face made her harsh features almost pleasant. The window was open. We heard her speak. "Come along, darling," she said. "We're late." He put the baby back in the pram, and they came up the door of Miss Gray's house and rang the bell. The maid showed them in. They shook hands with Miss Gray, and because I was standing near, she introduced me to them. Then she turned to the judge. "And this is Sir Edward Landon, Mr. and Mrs. Craig." One would have expected the judge to move forward with an outstretched hand, but he remained stock still. He put his eyeglass up to his eye, that eyeglass that I had on more than one occasion seen him use with devastating effect in court, and stared at the newcomers. "Gosh, what a dirty customer," I said to myself. He let the glass drop from his eye. "How do you do?" he said. "Am I mistaken in thinking that we've met before?" The question turned my eyes to the Craigs. They stood side by side, close to one another, as though they'd drawn together for mutual protection. They didn't speak. Mrs. Craig looked terrified. Craig's red face was darkened by a purple flush, and his eyes appeared almost to start out of his head. But that only lasted a second. "I don't think so," he said in a rich, deep voice. "Of course I've heard of you, Sir Edward." "More people know Tom Fool than Tom Fool knows," said the judge. Miss Gray, meanwhile, had been given the cocktail shaker a shake, and now she handed cocktails to her two guests. She had noticed nothing. I didn't know what it all meant. In fact, I wasn't sure it meant anything. The incident passed so quickly that I was half inclined to think that I had read into the stranger's momentary embarrassment on being introduced to a celebrated man something for which there was no foundation. I set about making myself pleasant. I asked them how they liked the Riviera and if they were comfortable in their house. Miss Gray joined in, and we chatted, as one does with strangers, of commonplace things. They talked easily and pleasantly. Mrs. Craig said how much they enjoyed the bathing and complained of the difficulty of getting fish at the seaside. I was aware that the judge didn't join in the conversation, but looked down at his feet as though he were unconscious of the company. Lunch was announced and we went into the dining room. We were only five, and it was a small round table, so the conversation couldn't be anything but general. I must confess that it was carried on chiefly by Miss Gray and myself. The judge was silent, but he often was, for he was a moody creature, and I paid no attention. The Craig struck me as a little shy, but that didn't surprise me. And as the second course was produced, they began to talk more freely. It didn't strike me that they were very amusing people, and I couldn't help thinking that Miss Gray had erred in making their acquaintance. Then suddenly, something happened. Craig rose abruptly from his chair and fell headlong to the floor. We jumped up. Mrs. Craig threw herself down over her husband and took his head in her hands. "It's all right, George," she cried in an agonized tone. "It's all right." "Put his head down," I said. "He's only fainted." I felt his pulse and could feel nothing. I said he had fainted, but I wasn't sure it wasn't a stroke. Miss Gray dipped her napkin into water and dabbed his forehead. Mrs. Craig seemed distraught. Then I noticed that Landon had remained quietly seated in his chair. "If he's fainted, you're not helping him to recover by crowding round him," he said acidly. Mrs. Craig turned her head and gave him a look of bitter hatred. "I'll ring up the doctor," said Miss Gray. "No, I don't think that's necessary," I said. "He's coming too." I could feel his pulse growing stronger, and in a minute or two he opened his eyes. I got him to drink a glass of brandy, and the colour came back to his face. "I feel all right now," he said. "We'll get you into the next room and you can lie on the sofa a bit." "No, I'd sooner go home. It's only a step." He got up from the floor. "Yes, let's go back," said Mrs. Craig. She turned to Miss Gray. "I'm so sorry. He's never done anything like this before." They were determined to go, and I thought myself it was the best thing for them to do. Mrs. Craig took one of his arms and I took the other. Miss Gray opened the door, and though still a bit shaky, he was able to walk. When we arrived at the Craigs' home, I offered to go in and help him undress, but they would neither hear of it. I went back to Miss Gray's and found them at dessert. I wonder why he fainted, Miss Gray was saying. All the windows are open. It's not particularly hot today. I wonder, said the judge. We had our coffee, and then since the judge and I were going to play golf, we got into the car and drove up the hill to my house. How did Miss Gray get to know these people? Landon asked me. They struck me as rather second-rate. I shouldn't have thought they were very much her mark. You know women, she likes her privacy, and when they settled in next door, she was quite decided that she wouldn't have anything to do with them. But when she discovered that they didn't want to have anything to do with her, she couldn't rest till she'd made their acquaintance. I told him the story she had invented about her neighbours. He listened with an expressionless face. I'm afraid your friend Miss Gray is a sentimental donkey, my dear fellow, he said when I'd come to an end. What do you know about the Craigs? I asked. He gave me a frigid glance. I? Why should I know anything about them? I thought they were very ordinary people. I wish I knew how to describe the strong impression he gave me, both by the glacial austerity of his look and by the rasping finality of his tone, that he was not prepared to say anything more. Landon was well on in the 60s, and he was the kind of golfer who never hits a long ball, but is never off the straight, and he was a deadly putter. So though he gave me strokes, he beat me handsomely. After dinner, I took him into Monte Carlo, where he finished the evening by winning a few thousand francs at the roulette table. These successive events put him into a remarkably good humour. A very pleasant day, he said when we parted for the night. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I spent the next morning at work, and we didn't meet till lunch. We were just finishing when I was called to the telephone. That was Miss Gray, I said. Oh? What had she to say? The Craigs have done a bolt. They disappeared last night. The maids live in the village, and when they came this morning, they found the house empty. They'd skipped and taken their luggage with them. They left money on the table for the maids' wages, the rent to the end of their tenancy, and the tradesmen's bills. The judge said nothing. He took a cigar from the box, examined it carefully, and then lit it with deliberation. What have you got to say about that? I asked. Why should I have anything to say? You can't imagine I'm such a fool as not to have noticed that you and the Craigs had met before, and if they vanished into thin air, like figments of the imagination, it's a fairly reasonable conclusion that the circumstances on which you met were not altogether pleasant. The judge gave a little chuckle, and there was a twinkle in his cold blue eyes. Do you remember the Wingford murder? He asked me. No. Perhaps you weren't in England at the time. Pity. You might have come to the trial. You'd have enjoyed it. It caused a lot of excitement, and the papers were full of it. Miss Wingford was a rich spinster, mature age, who lived in the country with a companion. She was a healthy woman, and when she died rather suddenly, her friends were surprised. Her physician, a fellow called Brandon, signed the certificate, and she was duly buried. The will was read, and it appeared that she had left everything she had, something between 60,000 and 70,000 pounds, to her companion. The relatives were very sore, but there was nothing they could do about it. The will had been drawn up by her doctor and witnessed by his clerk and Dr. Brandon. But Miss Wingford had a maid who had been with her for 30 years and had always understood that she would be remembered in the will. When she found that she wasn't even mentioned, she flew into a passion. She told the nephew and the two nieces who had come down for the funeral that she was sure Miss Wingford had been poisoned, and she said that if they didn't go to the police, she'd go herself. Well, they didn't do that, but they went to see Dr. Brandon. He laughed. He said that Miss Wingford had had a weak heart, and he'd been treating her for years. She died just as he had always expected her to die, peacefully in her sleep. And he advised them not to pay any attention to what the maids said. She'd always hated the companion, a Miss Starling, and had been jealous of her. Dr. Brandon was highly respected. He'd been Miss Wingford's doctor for a long time, and the two nieces who stayed with her often knew him well. He was not profiting by the will, and there seemed no reason to doubt his word. So the family thought there was nothing to do but make the best of a bad job and went back to London. But the maid went on talking. She talked so much that at last the police, much against their will, were obliged to take notice, and an order to exhume the body was made. There was an inquest, and it was found that Miss Wingford had died from an overdose of Veronal. The coroner's jury found that it had been administered by Miss Starling, and she was arrested. A detective was sent down from Scotland Yard, and he got together some unexpected evidence. It appeared that there had been a good deal of gossip about Miss Starling and Dr. Brandon, and the general impression in the village was that they were only waiting for Miss Wingford to die to get married. That put a very different complexion on the case. To make a long story short, the police got enough evidence, in their opinion, to justify them in arresting the doctor and charging him and Miss Starling with the murder of the old lady. The case came up for trial before me. The case for the prosecution was that the accused were in love with one another and had done the poor old lady to death so that they could marry on the fortune Miss Starling had wheedled her employer into leaving her. Miss Wingford always had a cup of cocoa when she went to bed, which Miss Starling prepared for her, and the counsel for the prosecution claimed that it was in this that Miss Starling had dissolved the tablets that caused Miss Wingford's death. The accused elected to give evidence on their own behalf, and they made a miserable showing in the witness box. They lied their heads off. The witnesses testified that they had seen them walking together at night with their arms round one another, though Brandon's maid testified that she had seen them kissing one another in the doctor's house. They swore they were no more than friends. And oddly enough, medical evidence proved that Miss Starling was Virgo intacta. Brandon admitted that he had given Miss Wingford a bottle of Veronal tablets because she complained of sleeplessness, but declared that he had warned her never to take more than one, and then only when absolutely necessary. The defense sought to prove that she had taken the tablets either by accident or because she wanted to commit suicide. That didn't hold water for a moment. Miss Wingford was a jolly, normal old lady who thoroughly enjoyed life. She hadn't complained to the maid of sleeping badly. In fact, her maid had always thought her a very good sleeper. It was impossible to believe that she had accidentally taken a sufficient number of tablets to kill herself. Personally, I had no doubt that it was a put-up job between the doctor and the companion. The motive was obvious and sufficient. I summed up, and I hope summed up fairly. But it was my duty to put the facts before the jury, and to my mind the facts were damning. The jury filed out. I don't suppose you know that when you're sitting on the bench, you somehow get the feeling of the court. You have to be on your guard against it to be sure it doesn't influence you. I never had it more strongly than on that day that there wasn't a soul in court who wasn't convinced that those two people had committed the crime with which they were charged. I hadn't the shadow of a doubt that the jury would bring in a verdict of guilty. Juries are incalculable. They were out for 3 hours, and when they came back, I knew at once that I was mistaken. In a murder case, when a jury is going to bring in a verdict of guilty, they won't look at the prisoner, they look away. I noticed that 3 or 4 of the jurymen glanced at the two prisoners in the dock. They brought in a verdict of not guilty. The real names of Mr. and Mrs. Craig are Dr. and Mrs. Brandon. I'm just as certain as I am that I'm sitting here that they committed between them a cruel and heartless murder and richly deserved to be hanged. What do you think made the jury find them not guilty? I asked. I've asked myself that, and you know the only explanation I can give? The fact that it was conclusively proved that they had never been lovers. And if you come to think of it, that's one of the most curious features of the whole case. That woman was prepared to commit murder to get the man she loved, but she wasn't prepared to have an illicit love affair with him.